Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, and thank you for joining me. My name is Chrissy Hodges, and you're listening to Mental Illness Matters Radio. This is where we talk about all topics, mental health, including lived experiences of different mental illnesses, and typically things that are driven by stigma surrounding mental illness and mental health in general. Today we've got a great show. Pat Atwell is going to join us here in just a minute. We're going to talk about psychiatric hospitalization. Huge topic when it comes to mental illness, and one that is very highly stigmatized. However, sometimes it's necessary, even though it can be a traumatic experience, and sometimes it's a great experience, as we'll see today on the show. It is that time where a lot of people can gain some insight into their illness. So I just saw that Kat called in. Hi, Kat.
Hello.
I was wondering if we should tell them a little preview of our news.
Oh, I thoroughly encourage that, yes.
Well, for those of you that may be listening, we Kat and I are going to start something new, right, Kat?
Exactly.
And but we don't want to tell too many details because then it would ruin the surprise, and oh, is it going to be a good surprise?
It really is. I'm super duper excited. So it yes, you too should be very excited about some changes that are afoot.
So that doesn't mean that the show's going to go away completely. This has been such an incredible journey. But, you know, I think that it's going to change here in the next couple weeks into a different little venue with some humor. And you will definitely know that when we reveal the title here soon. Any thoughts on what you think is going to be coming up and your excitement about it, Kat?
It just energizes me. I think that our approach towards mental health topics is going to, I think, open the door for a lot of people and recognize that while we may live with mental illness, it doesn't have to be serious and dire all the time. It, obviously, that's going to be there, but so is a lot of humor, and we can't take ourselves too seriously, as you will learn soon.
Yay! So that information will come out soon enough. I guess it's probably safe to say this will be the last show titled Mental Illness Matters Radio. And for all of you who have been with me through that journey for the last several years, just so you know, your continued support is always greatly appreciated, and everything that you've, all the feedback I've gotten and continue to get from you, I hope that that will stay the course and that you will love the direction that we're going in with this new show. So Kat, why don't you introduce yourself for anybody that may be listening who may not know who you are?
Absolutely. My name is Kat Atwell, and I met Chrissy through This Is My Brave, which is a show where people share lived experience with mental illness through essay and song and poetry, and we hit it off right away. I have been advocating for people living with mental illness for quite some time. I myself was formally diagnosed in 2006, but didn't really jump on the bandwagon of advocacy, I guess, really until 2010 when I lost a friend of mine to depression. So in the meantime, I am a comedian, and I'm a mom, and I write, and I help people with their retirement planning.
Excellent. We all need help with that. So today's topic, I was just telling everybody, Kat, is psychiatric hospitalization. And I think that there's a lot to discuss on this topic. Kat and I are going to kick it off for a little while. Jody Gammel is going to come on and join us probably a little over halfway into the show and give his valuable 2 cents worth. It is important to let you know that all three of us have experienced being hospitalized, and so we all three come from different perspectives because we were in different places at different places in our lives And so one of us may have an experience, the other doesn't necessarily, it may not be as congruent, but that it's all worth sharing and listening to. I was just saying, Kat, before you came on, that psychiatric hospitalization can be negative and it can be positive, but a lot of times it's very much needed for people, even when they don't know it, which is part of my story. But I'm going to let you kind of kick us off and tell us a little bit about your thoughts on hospitalization. And if you'd like to share some of your story, that'd be awesome.
Absolutely. Well, I think that my experience was overwhelmingly positive, albeit if you'd asked me at the moment, I would have disagreed. And my experience with hospitalization is also going to be different in that I, much like childbirth, I've blocked out a lot. I believe I stayed overnight once, but then the majority of my experience with hospitalization was intensive outpatient. So I spent, I think, 10 days, 8 to 10 hours a day that I was required to be at the hospital going through various exercises and group therapy meetings and art therapy and a lot of intensive meetings with psychologists, psychiatrists while we try to determine medication stuff. I think that up until that happened to me, which was in, I think, April of 2006, I was under the misguided belief that you were admitted to a psychiatric, you know, branch of a hospital or a psychiatric hospital if you had attempted a suicide, and that was it. And in my situation, I did not. However, my husband had gotten to the point where my coping skills had gone out the window, and he'd reached the point where he didn't know how to help me either. And so, you know, the likelihood of me having done something more harmful to myself is very likely had he not had the courage to take me to the emergency room first, because my depression had all but swallowed me up entirely. So, I mean, that's the very basic of my backstory. Chrissy, do you want me to talk about the feelings that I had when I was in there, or where do you want me to go with this?
I mean, I think that's probably one of the biggest obstacles with people hospitalized is it, you know, from an outside perspective, it would be you're sick, you just need to get treatment. But there is a big stew of emotion simmering, I think, for people underneath that, just go to the hospital, you're sick, when it comes to mental illness. And a lot of those emotions don't get addressed, and we have to carry them out into the world after we experience time in the hospital. So absolutely, I think it's the most important part of it.
Okay, for sure. So I would say at the moment that my husband told me that he was going to take me to the hospital, I felt immediately very embarrassed and very ashamed of myself. Embarrassment, shame, mm-hmm. and intense anxiety about money. I thought that that in order to go to the hospital, you had to have physical wounds. And because this was a while ago and I really hadn't invested in my own mental health all that much, and I saw myself as a burden. And that was horrifying. That was awful. I felt like I was on display in the worst, ugliest way. Mm-hmm. But I didn't, to my credit, I had no energy to defend any of my negative thoughts because I was just so defeated by my depression at that point in time. I was too tired. And so I would say those were the biggies when I got there. I could not stop apologizing to people. You know, I thought the doctors had more important things to do. Yeah, I felt like this was I should have been able to take care of this myself. And I think a lot of that comes from stigma with the way that we've been raised and, you know, and what's out there in the news. And like you've seen in TV and movies that you've got to be, you know, completely gone, like no chance of return. It's essentially a prison, I would say. If you have to go onto a unit for any mental health care. So that was, I'd say, the overwhelming negative that I started with. What about you, Chrissy?
Well, I concur with everything. The end.
All right. Well, we're glad that you chimed in.
No, I like how you articulated a lot of that, especially about being on display in the worst and most negative way. In my story, and I think one of the reasons why I wanted to do this particular episode this week is this has been at the forefront of my mind recently, not only with my job and watching people and working with people that are in an inpatient lock setting, but because there's a lot of attention now in Colorado when it comes to mental health holds, 72-hour holds, and being hospitalized and being involuntarily hospitalized and what that means and what that looks like. But I can see both sides of the fence, and so I think I wanted to just talk about it out loud to get my perspective out in the open. I was involuntarily hospitalized, and this, you know, and fortunately it wasn't like put me in a straitjacket and, you know, put me in the back of a police car and take me into the hospital. I mean, I guess I went willingly, but I didn't have a choice to go willingly, really. It was, I had had a suicide attempt and I was in the hospital having surgery, and basically everybody walked in and sat down and I just said, what's happening next? When do I get to go home? And my family and doctor said, oh, you're not going home. You're going to a psychiatric hospital. And that's when I was pissed and wanted to, like, my head felt like it was going to explode. And all of a sudden, all of the imagery of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest came into my head. And I thought, I just kept thinking, why? This, none of this is my fault. I didn't ask for any of this. So, And the anger of this is punishment for how embarrassed and ashamed my family is of me from the suicide attempt. So to me, it felt like, I don't know, my duty to my family, because I thought, well, they're so ashamed of me that they want me to go off to this hospital because they don't want to deal with me. I mean, I still had no idea that I had a mental illness, and that in itself was the, I almost said the F-bomb, was the problem, is right there. You know, when someone finds out that there's something wrong with you, that something horrible has happened to you or with you in a physical illness, you know, you're going to sit down and have a consultation, and we think this is going on. We need to explore this more. We need to do all these tests. We need to do this. But everything's going to hopefully be okay. We have hope. It was not like that with a mental illness. It wasn't even like you have a mental illness. It was, you're going to a psychiatric facility, deal with it. And so in that respect, it felt like I had done something wrong and now I'm getting punished, which is the exact opposite of how we should be treating people who don't have insight yet that they have an illness and that recovery is possible. So those are just kind of like my first thoughts on it. Obviously I have many, many more about what it was like being hospitalized in a locked unit, but I wanted to address one of the things that you said, Kat, which was you couldn't stop apologizing to people. And this is probably, I think this displays in itself stigma right in the forefront of why in the F do we have to apologize for something we didn't cause? So, Can you speak a little bit more about what that means when you said that, and why it's such an issue, and maybe what can we do about that moving forward?
Yeah, for sure. I wanted to mention, too, when you made the remark about how you thought that your family had kind of just been so ashamed. It seemed to me like you were explaining it as being put in like the absolute worst timeout possible.
to say the least. You know?
Right. So with my apologizing, and I still deal with this, everyone. I think so much of that for me is self-stigma. I feel when I am at my very low points or out of control, incapable of making solid decisions for myself, that I, by default, that having to, air quotes, deal with me is problematic and putting other people in a position that they don't want to be in. By default, I feel like a nuisance. And, mm-hmm. you know, that thought had to have been developed somewhere, because person isn't born thinking, if I'm struggling, I'm the problem.
True.
So, yeah. And you don't see a whole lot on the news or on television about success stories. You know, if an athlete has torn their ACL and been hospitalized and gone through physical therapy, they are met with cheers when they come out of the hospital. Nobody judges them for going to the hospital to have surgery done or to go through rehabilitation. What was the movie, by the way? It was set, I think, in the 60s with Winona Ryder and Angelina Jolie.
Girl Interrupted.
Yes, that's what I picture in my head, too, when I think about psychiatric units and hospitals. And so that mm-hmm. that's my stereotype that I carry with me, which is not that far gone from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, frankly. I remember even when I was going, because I didn't go to a specific psychiatric hospital. I went to a hospital with a psychiatric unit, but you had to have a code to get onto the particular floor. And so those of us that were doing this program and having to be there, I mean, it was just shameful to have to press the eighth floor. I mean, people immediately mm-hmm. looked at you weird. And
right.
And so, yeah, it was like, I didn't even have to open my mouth and I'm already judged. Yeah, I know I went off the apology track, but so much of it just feels like, yeah, your family and your friends can't handle you anymore, which is totally okay. If I broke my leg, my family and friends couldn't handle that either.
Right.
And not because it's like, I don't have time to, you know, put her leg in a cast, but because they legitimately don't know how.
Right.
That's, I think, the approach that we have to have towards mental health, too. It's not that somebody doesn't want us around. It's that the friends and family who love us recognize that they do not have the tools, they are not equipped, especially in those times when hospitalization is required, to help us.
Right. Well, I did a lot of apologizing during and shortly after, and I can effectively say that I no longer apologize. I mean, it's 19 years later, but I think that one of the things that you said, where it goes, where you said where we had to have learned that somewhere, I think that's mm-hmm. I think that's the biggest and the scariest thing, and I also think that in the moment of being diagnosed with a mental illness or having to spend time in a hospital, you don't know what else to do because you aren't able to stand in the confidence of it yet. And so when we aren't confident about something, and I'm going to go ahead and play the woman card here, and not in a good way. Women especially, I know that was such a contradicting statement. It was unbelievable. You know, women especially, I think before we can wrap our heads around something, we just default to apologizing. And say, well, yeah, I'm really sorry you have to go through this because of me or something. And so I think that's what I did, is I didn't know what else to do. And I didn't know that I had a right to be assertive, or a right to ask for what I wanted, or a right to think I deserved a good life. And so the only thing I knew how to do outside from that confidence was say how sorry I was. And frankly, that's bullshit. But I think that the system is set up that way, and I think that it's set up for people in the hospital. When you walk into a hospital, that you have to feel sorry, because a lot of times you're met with people, you know, staff who treat you like you have something to apologize about. And I think that was my experience in the hospital. But I want to shift gears right there for my own personal story, is the people that I met in the hospital who were sick were my, that was the reason why things turned around for me in the hospital, is, and I see it happen in my place of employment as well, watching peers meet each other and support each other. And if it weren't for those people, I don't know where I would be right now. At first I hated them. I thought that they were all going to be throwing feces and, you know, that there would be like fights breaking out like every minute, or, you know, people would be like sneaking in my room and like hurting me and, or, you know, sexually assaulting me and stuff like that. But that is not what it was about. And I am lucky. I mean, I remember specifically, and this is a horrible, horrible story. You know, those stories you have and you think, I can't believe I was such a horrible human being, and you don't know where the person is that you were so mean to, and you can't apologize, but you know you were wrong. I was, when I first got into the hospital, I hated everybody and thought I was better than everybody, because I'm a brat. And there was this gal that came, and she stuck her head in my room, and she went, hey, I'm so-and-so, and I just wanted to welcome you here, and, you know, I'm sorry that you're feeling bad. And I looked at her and went, are you done? And, like, gave her the meanest look, because I was like, I'm not talking to this mentally ill people. And I hate myself. And I remember saying it out loud and thinking, Chrissy, you're the biggest jerk. Why would you say that? But, you know, I was so mad, and I didn't think I belonged there, and I didn't know anything about mental illness, and that's where we fail people. You know, I mean, if I had known, I wouldn't have looked at this person and said, she's just a nut job, I'm not talking to her. And then, you know, unfortunately, she left by the time I started being nice and actually making friends and not being such an asshole. And so I never got to apologize to her. But that's where we're failing people. I mean, we should be, when people are diagnosed, when they're admitted into a hospital or even an intensive outpatient treatment, we should sit them down and go, this is your ticket to recovery. You are going to, this is going to be awesome for you. Recovery is possible for anybody. If you work the, you know, if you work the program, it will work for, you know, that's what we should be doing. And instead we don't. Instead, we set people up to feel like we felt, and we're still doing it. Amen.
Hallelujah. I want to just point out that you can use the word asshole, but then use the word feces. Oh, your choice of when to swear and when not to swear is hysterical. I'll agree with you too. I think if my initial meeting, and unfortunately, I'm not sure in your case, but I went through the ER first, was not a welcoming kind of, hey, you're not okay, we are here to help you, as opposed to a very clinical, the first thing we need to do is sit you down and psychoanalyze the crap out of you, which is what I vaguely remember happened to me. And again, I'm not going to trust my memory 1,000%, but that's what I recall, is like essentially being shuffled off to a doctor after, you know, tons of paperwork.
And there wasn't a lot of reassurance, if any, that I can recall.
Right.
And there certainly wasn't a, hey, you get the opportunity to do this and to, you know, give yourself a break, because that's one of the things that resulted from my personal experience. I was looking at it very much like I suggested you had, as an enormous punishment. And, you know, like I'd been grounded, but in a hospital. And if they had told me up front, you know, this is a loving environment, we do this work because we care for people and we want to keep you safe. I mean, granted, when you're in a state of depression or mania or, you know, psychosis, any of those things, a lot of the stuff that I'm saying right now, I don't know if I would have heard anyway, but it certainly would have been better than, you know, a very black and white stern experience where not only, you know, do I feel like apologizing, but yeah, I want to crawl under a bed and just disappear. And I too remember when I started meeting people, I think everybody did this too. It's like when you're in a poker game and you're kind of giving side eye to everyone going, well, what is your hand? I wonder what that person's holding. I'm sure that I have the best hand here because everybody else has got to be batshit because I clearly am fine. And to imagine that everybody on the same floor, and I, you know, again, grand assumption, and Chrissy, you can disagree, but the vast majority of people there are probably thinking the same thing of everybody else in the room when they're new.
Oh, yeah.
We're all judging each other, and that, too, is a problem. You know, allow patients to be welcoming of other patients. It's like when you go to an AA meeting. The first thing you do is go around and greet each other in a loving way. And and not there. It just, it's like, you know, it's even on the floor, you still feel embarrassed and shameful, even though everybody else in that same space is going through similar things. It makes no sense. And I it's frustrating, but yeah, once you get to know everyone, for the vast majority of people that I met, they were lovely. And shockingly enough, they're all human.
Right.
Yeah, because I think we lose some of the humanity in mental illness, which makes no sense and is so sad. But we forget the people behind the mental illness, even when we are the ones with it. So, yeah, mine wound up being a great experience. And as, you know, as my time progressed, it was a realization of, holy smokes, my brain was really going in a million directions at once. And I was pounding myself with negative reinforcement. No wonder I'm here now, because I am learning tools and I am feeling better. I'm being medicated. I got to do stuff like art therapy, which I loved, and hearing other people's stories. But yeah, that kind of sneaks up on you. You don't realize what the benefits are. And if they shared those at the beginning, not with you know, the patient, then with the patient's family, as opposed to, you know, shuffling them away and essentially vaguely telling them, you know, we'll take care of it. There's a lot of mystery surrounding the experience. And for me, overwhelmingly, I would say it was positive, but it took a while for me to see the brighter light and the hope that they actually helped me rediscover during that period of time.
And I agree with the, you know, when other people come into the hospital, you're kind of wary of them. And I think one of the things I try to remind patients that I'm working with, when someone comes in and yeah, they're being really annoying or they're being loud or they're in their symptoms, is this person is really, really sick right now. And if you just give them the empathy and compassion and give them some time, you know, they will be able to normalize to what is going to put them in a place that's going to make them more successful. Because, you know, I always say this, I have no idea what it feels like to be in a relapse and OCD and depression symptoms when I'm out of it. And when I'm out of it, I can't remember what it's like to be out of it. That's, if that made sense. So it is
totally
like being it is being like two different people. And so when I come out of a depression, all of a sudden it's like, okay, you know, I'm done now. Forget that. I don't even want to remember that. And so when I see people in that space, and it's hard for me to remember what it's like, because it is so miserable to be there, and you want to forget it. But I guess what I'm trying to say is, people who are symptomatic, symptoms can be really scary, you know, and they can be really scary for family members, and they can be really scary for you know, your spouse or friends when someone is experiencing, you know, especially psychosis or, you know, mania, or things that are a little more outward, or OCD symptoms where you're constantly asking for support or you're having these behaviors. They can be really scary. But that doesn't mean that the person is scary. And that doesn't mean that the person doesn't need help. One of the things that you were saying, something clicked in my brain. Whenever I have been to the doctor with a physical ailment, the conversation always starts with, oh, well, there's several treatments we can do for this, but this is what you've got, and this is how we can help. You know, why aren't we doing that? Why aren't we saying that with, you know, before you're diagnosed with whatever or however many mental illnesses, you know, a person's going to end up with? You know, why aren't we saying, just so you know, there are many treatments that you can explore and that can help you and that can get you back on your feet? Instead, it's like this big sigh of, well, you've got bipolar disorder, you've got this, and good luck.
It's like it's like going to a mechanic and you're like, well, I'm not sure what's going on, but it's making a little rattly noise. You are never going to walk back into a mechanic and have them go, you know what, good news. These are the options. Usually it's, well, you need completely new brake system. I mean, and you don't know that there are other options available.
Right.
It's just a big sad trombone noise.
I wish right now I had that noise that I could play.
Wah, wah.
Or on like the Price Is, yeah, the Price Is Right, when you lose on the Price Is Right.
Exactly.
I think that we've identified the problem. So now, how are Kat and Chrissy going to fix this nationwide problem?
Everyone have faith.
The big problem is, why aren't we offering people hope for at the moment of diagnosis? And where is that coming from? Who is it coming from? And why are we letting them get away with it?
I would actually take that one step further and say, why don't we have more resources readily available, publicized, and out there for people? So that they're aware that this could, you know, sometimes happen. And, you know, here are materials that you can use before a mental health crisis occurs. And, you know, I mean, I just think that if we had more preventive tools, I mean, all you hear about when you go into it for a physical is preventive medicine. And that's really the choice that we should pursue. But we have little to no preventive care when it comes to mental illness.
Well, what is preventive care? I mean, I'm just being honest. Like, what does that look like? Because, and the reason why I'm asking is, I mean, I'm I can only speak from my own lived experience, but I don't know. If I had had education on the topic, absolutely, it could have been preventative of my suicide attempt. But other than education on that illness, I don't know, because, okay, and the reason why is, and I think this is a big thing too for people that go in the hospital, is when I was in the hospital, I don't belong here. I am not one of these people. And so that is a misguided belief of, I'm sorry, the middle and upper class. I mean, mostly I'm just throwing it out there, but it's true. Like, we are not one of those people. Those things happen to homeless people and poor people and lazy people. And so I don't know. I mean, I knew about depression, and I've said this before, like I was even in a class that was talking about OCD, and I leaned over to the girl sitting next to me. I went, "Those hand washers are crazy." I mean, and I had it. Granted, if that professor had said OCD also entails thoughts of sexual obsessions, like worrying you're going to, you know, be attracted to someone in your family, or worried you're going to, you know, turn gay, or worried you're going to turn into a violent killer, or worried if you're gay, you're going to turn straight. I mean, if that had happened, I may have been like, whoa, what? So I guess education would be a preventative tool. Other than that, I knew I had heard about everything you could do for depression, but in my depression, I was going, I am not depressed. In my suicidal ideation and like planning my suicide attempt, I was like, no way am I depressed. I mean, what is that? I mean,
right?
What is that? Why?
I think a lot of times, you know, again, speaking for myself, it's, you know, with mental illness, so many of us have hyperactive imaginations. And I'm guessing, you know, and I'm sure you could say this about any number of illnesses, but, you know, I was a really high achiever when I was growing up. And and I think a lot of times, I'm sure I had symptoms of mental illness when I was younger. I know I did. But that I try to overcompensate, because I wasn't being treated then by working harder to you know, appear normal, I guess, for lack of a better word. And I think when you're so familiar with it and you've gotten to the point where you are, you know, you're used to faking it on a good day. So on a bad day, you just assume you're upping your game and that nobody can see it. And it's like, well, you know, duh, but this is something I've lived with forever. So why would you think that I can't do it now? We're creative, problem-solving people. And, you know, we try and take rational approaches to an illness which, you know, feels and looks completely irrational. It just, you know, one of the things that my therapist tells me is, you know, you try and rationalize thoughts that your brain is telling you. And it's like, well, you know, you can't beat your thinking by thinking more.
I know, overthinking, thinking.
Right, exactly.
Thinking squared.
Yes. It's meta thinking. I don't even know if I answered your question appropriately. I would say too, as far as preventive care is concerned, the bulk of it is education, but I would say it's also, you know, more tools that many of us are aware of, you know, meditation and journaling and, you know, artistic creative endeavors that can help us. Yeah, there's exercise. There's always going to be exercise. But for me, exercise at that point in time was so exhausting. I mean, I was wiped out just getting up from the couch and going to the bathroom.
Right.
you know, I know that it's all tied together. Maybe that's just me being angry earlier, but I do think education is more important. When we grow up in elementary school, gym class doesn't ever talk about, you know, it's physical fitness, obviously. We don't have any mental equivalent to that in schools as far as self-care. And so maybe, yes, I'll land on that one. That's what I want.
I think, I think education is the piece, because it became really clear to me when you said preventative measures. I would not have been interested in preventative measures, because I would never want to believe that I was mentally ill, and I would want to believe that I was above that, those people. I mean, and unfortunately that's how I thought. This was not a reality, but a lot of things I thought were not a reality. Let's just say that out loud. but I mean, so, you know, we have this task force right now in Denver, looking on what to do with Bull and how to handle people on M1 holds that are going to be going into a psychiatric facility involuntarily or in rural areas. They're wanting to hold people in jails. Boo to that.
Boo. Big boo.
Exactly. And so I think we just hit the nail on the head of what I want to speak about to them on Wednesday, which is education is the only way to get people to stand up and listen and ask for help. Education and having people share their lived experience. Because I'm going to tell you, you know, if someone had stood up in front of me in high school and middle school and elementary school or whatever and run down the list of OCD obsessions, I may have gone, holy crap, I think I can ask for help. And that would have given me the courage because then the outcome is at least determined versus finding the courage to tell someone and then like bracing yourself for the impact of being taken away in a straitjacket.
Oh yeah, definitely. I think that if we started sooner and like you said, first person lived experience and more of that sort of education would change so much, especially for younger people, but for adults too, like in the workplace. Chrissy and I both have gone out in our community to speak about our personal experiences. And, you know, 99.9% of the time, it's to either to policemen or to people who are already in a hospital to talk to them, which I think is an amazing tool. Sometimes faith communities. But beyond that, I think the most unique one and easily the most fulfilling one I ever had was I got to go speak at a retirement community. And it was, I actually got a letter from somebody saying that they had been estranged from, I think their son, who had mental illness, and they just didn't understand. And after our talk, they realized that they had been incorrect, and it actually reunited their family. If we had companies reaching out, I mean, it's huge. And more willing to do this other than people who are already dealing in crisis kind of situation, frankly. You know, we're talking to first responders a lot of the time. And
right,
we should be talking to everybody.
Everybody. Speaking of talking to everybody, Jody Gamble is joining us.
That was the best segue ever, by the way.
Hey, Chrissy and Kat.
Hey!
Hello.
How are you?
I am doing just wonderful.
So you've just entered when Kat and I have solved the problem, and we need to now take it nationwide on how to solve the problem of stigma, of hospitalization, and asking for help for mental illness. So you heard it firsthand.
Yeah, I think this has been a really good talk, and I look forward to taking over the world now. Super stoked.
There's no other choice.
So, Jody, tell us, chime in and tell us who you are, a little bit about yourself, and then weigh in on some of your – Kat and I have been – I can't believe 40 minutes has already passed by now. But Kat and I have talked about our experience with hospitalization. Talk a little bit about what hospitalization was like for you.
Okay. My name's Jody Gamble, and I'm living successfully with bipolar disorder. I have had several hospitalizations, just kind of not go into too much detail with each one, but, the first time that I was hospitalized, it was a relief because I, you know, thought, okay, here we go. They're going to put me in the hospital. They're going to put me on a medication. I'm going to get all better. then I can get on with my life and everything will be just fine. But that did not happen. Basically it was a learning experience. You know, I learned, that I needed to go in voluntarily every time that they wanted to hospitalize me, because, you know, if you go in voluntarily, you can leave whenever you decide. You know, and I just remember being learning what I needed to say in groups, and, you know, I would take this survey, and it would say, you know, are you ready to leave the hospital? And I would never say yes, because I thought, if I say yes, then I'm not letting them make the decision, so they'll tell me no. So I always wrote in, you know, whenever the doctors feel that I'm ready. So, yeah. Do you have any specific questions for me as to my experiences in the hospital?
Well, what was your emotional response to being hospitalized and all of the times that you were in the hospital? I mean, what did it make you feel like? Maybe from an outsider's perspective, what you thought people thought about you, or kind of an overlying emotional theme of being in there?
You know, I think I buried my head in the sand a lot about being in the hospital. I was like, you know, the main thing that I care about is that nobody knows about this. And, you know, my family, you know, it's, yeah. And, you know, I just, it was just a lot of guilt. Like, you know, what did I do in my life, like karmically, to, you know, bring this on myself? Like, I felt totally responsible. You know, it wasn't the chemicals in my brain. It was my lifestyle and how I had made bad decisions. There was just a lot of beating myself up in my mind that I brought this on myself. So tremendous amounts of guilt.
And when you, so Jody works in the job very similar to mine, where we work as peer support specialists. So Jody, when you work with people that are in the hospital and as well as transitioning out of a hospital setting and loft units at that, do you see people experiencing those same emotions, and how does that make you feel?
I see a lot of people experiencing those same emotions. You know, one of the toughest parts of my job is taking somebody that, you know, doesn't want to be where they're at, doesn't feel like they deserve to be where they're at, and I can identify with that. But, you know, the beauty of my job is I can say, you know, this is not your last stop. You will, because I'm in the picture, you're not always going to be in this hospital. And so my challenge is to reignite that hope that, yes, you will be able to leave this hospital, that you're not going to be here forever. Because, you know, that's very easy to do. Like, you know, just talking about a situation where you think you'll be there forever, I was put in isolation, locked isolation, one time. And before I went in, one of the patients there told me, he's like, you know, they're going to give you an extremely difficult, if not impossible, puzzle to solve, and they're not going to let you out until you solve it. And so I went
Good
into
God.
That isolation. Yeah. I went into the isolation thinking, well, you know, I'm never, ever going to be released from it. And, you know, I think it goes beyond just locked isolations. I think a lot of people think, you know, this is the last stop for me. This is pretty much my life going forward.
Yeah.
Okay. Like
obviously
a giant
you solved
flushing.
The puzzle.
Yeah, thankfully that was a rumor. I might still be there. I'm not a good puzzle solver.
What did you say, Kat?
Oh, I said going into the hospital is just like a giant toilet flushing.
Mm-hmm.
You're welcome. So, Jody, we were, just so you can confirm my and Kat's plan for the world domination, what if when you went into the hospital, or the people that you work with and I went work with, when they are going into the hospital, what if they were met with I know this is not an ideal situation, but we have hope for you. This is a way for you to get better. And then they are offered hope and lived experience. And, you know, so many people can live successfully with your illness. How do you think that would change people going into the hospital?
You know, I think it would, for me at least, in my own experience, it would have been like my saving grace, because, you know, I would go into groups while I was in the hospital, and they turned into who can tell the biggest war story. And all I could see were these people that were stuck in their illness. And, you know, I'm very vocal that, you know, the turning point of my recovery was when I spoke with the director of our respite center that I worked at, and he was living successfully. He was in a successful position. He was living successfully with his challenges. And, you know, just to have that role model to be like, okay, yeah, you can do this. And I think I told somebody this the other day. It might have been you, Chrissy, but, like, you know, nobody could run a 4-minute mile. And then one person ran a 4-minute mile. Now people do it all the time. So for me, meeting James was like seeing somebody that had run the 4-minute mile. And,
well, I would like,
you know,
I would like to point something out, though, and not to be the negative Nancy in this discussion, but it took someone outside of the hospital to give you hope. Okay, there's the problem in itself. You had already been hospitalized. You had to come out of the hospital on your own accord, visit this respite center, and luckily ran into this gentleman. Why aren't we doing that in the hospital? That's my question.
Is it rhetorical?
I was thinking the same thing, Jody.
Okay,
let me answer part of it. I would say some hospitals really are trying to incorporate more of these shared stories, but it's not right away. And, you know, because I've spoken at some of these hospitals, and I'm so grateful for those places that are thinking outside the box and willing to look at a, you know, from a recovery standpoint. I don't think we emphasize the recovery so much, but and one more thing too that I wanted to mention, Jody, you talked about group therapy and it was a war story. Mine felt more like the most uncomfortable confession, like group confessional ever.
Yeah.
And I don't think it was one-upping. It just was like, well, now I'm going to get naked in front of everybody. It was just, it just felt gross.
And mine was run by intern.
I never went to a group like that, but.
Mine was run by interns who came in, and all of us wanted to murder them because they were like, I probably shouldn't say that about being in a psychiatric hospital. However, I mean, they're like 21, they were my age, coming in going, So tell me what's bothering you. And all of us would look at these people like, do you have any idea what you're even doing? You know what I mean? Like the little notepad, like I seriously wanted to take that notepad and strangle them. And so everybody felt that
with
way.
A notepad.
And so
that's impressive.
You could probably undo the wire.
No. Oh, Lord.
I don't know. I was very angry. I had anger issues in the hospital.
Question, like, you know, and I think in the hospital, I think, you know, we've got all the experts here. Why appear, you know? And I think that's where the movement's going to have to succeed is go, you know, yes, the clinicians are experts in their respective fields, but there's also a need for the peer as an expert, you know. And I just think it's just we haven't been in the movement long enough.
Right. Well,
for a second, I thought you said we haven't been in the mood long enough. Like, no, that's not really true.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Sorry, go do, yes, talk like grown ups now, and I'll be over here picking my nose.
Well, I think that unfortunately, this is the way I look at it, is that, you know, I wish that we could wipe the slate clean today, and everybody who's been in a psychiatric hospital and had a shitty experience, I'm sorry, I'm just letting them fly now, you know, that's had that experience, I wish we could just wipe it clean and say, I just use shitty and then wiping it clean in the same sentence. I wish we could just move forward and say, from now on, this is what we're going to do. But the truth is that's what I don't know. That's where I don't know what it's going to take. Because most people that I talk to say that they get their strength and their hope when they were hospitalized from the peers that they had inside of the hospital, not only surviving their illnesses and their symptoms and trying to get to a baseline of being able to work on things, but being able to survive the system and the staff. And that is where I feel like the problems really need to be addressed, but nobody is going to, I don't know why anyone is really looking at that and really not making a stand against it. Because when we do, we just sound like we're a bunch of complainers, right?
Well, you know, I think of Mother Teresa. She said one time that she would never attend an anti-war demonstration, but she would attend a pro-peace demonstration. And in my mind, that's how I look at things. Like, you know, I think if for me personally, if I go into the situation fighting the system, I'm not going to win. But if I can, in my own way, show the results of my work, my job is to make them feel like they can't say no. Like, I want to have proven myself in being vital in people's recovery so that they go, you know, given his track record, we would be dumb to say, you know, we don't need peers in the system. So, you know, and so I'm collecting my success story and, you know, going to be fully ready to, you know, take on the evidence-based argument, like, you know, this is, you know, you give us some evidence-based theory or ideas or practical knowledge that you have that this works. And I'm, you know, I'm arming myself with that.
Leave it to Jody to come up with the logical response in the midst of my
rage. I was
going to
say, I
want to do one of those. Yeah, that's what I meant. I wish I could post a meme right now.
But yeah.
Well, I like it. So there's our solution. And I mean that is a solution. And moving forward, I think I want to definitely end this post. Or in this show on the positive note, which Jody already did. but, you know, let's each share some final thoughts on, you know, moving forward. What is it that we can do to make hospitalization better for people and to know that there's hope, hope at the end of the tunnel of a diagnosis of a mental illness? Kat, why don't you kick us off?
Oh, thanks. No pressure. I would say for me, it's going to be continuing to share my story and not just to people who are already advocating for better mental health resources and care, but for people that don't know we need it yet and or oblivious to the fact that we need it, which is no fault of their own, but the fault of our system. And not only that, but on a more personal level too, communicating with my daughter, you know, early and making sure that she understands what I'm going through personally and how to ask for help, and that it's okay if you don't feel okay, as long as you can tell somebody about it. I think that a lot of times we shy away from talking about mental health situations with kids, and I'm not saying that you have
right.
to bring out the worst stories ever. You know, like you were saying, whoever has the best war story, that's not what the kids need, but sooner that they are aware that it's acceptable, the less people will be showing up in hospitals feeling like they're getting some sort of punishment.
Right. Love it. What do you think, Jody? End us with
me,
a quote.
Oh, goodness. I'm going to do a simple one at the end. So basically what I would like to say is the peer movement is strong. Every peer that I've met that's working in the profession, they are intelligent, humorous, positive, recovery oriented. I haven't met one yet that wasn't. So the peers are coming. That's the biggest message I have. And we're recovery oriented. You know, right after a clinician, you want to harm yourself or others, there's going to be a peer right behind them saying, what can we do to create the life that you want to live? And, you know, that's why I love being a peer, is I get to ask that question. Instead of that other question. So the peer movement's strong. We're coming your way. Tell your story. The power of story is unbelievable. And, you know, I'll end with Fun is Good by Dr. Seuss.
And we have had fun this hour. I want to in this call, it looks like we dropped Kat for some reason. She probably had to go, but I wanted to end by saying there is no limit to what sharing your story can do for people. And the reason why is so many people that are in the hospital, so many people that are suffering in silence, so many people that have shame and guilt associated with a mental health diagnosis really, truly believe they are alone. They could read an article, they could read this, they could read that every single day, but until they hear it coming out of someone's mouth and see the suffering, then that's when they will understand that there's help and there's hope. So I have dedicated my life and career to advocacy and just sharing the story. I don't care what the cost sometimes, because if one person had shared their story with me, I think it could have made a huge difference. So that's kind of my take. I've learned a lot in this hour of ways to direct my focus when it comes to hospitalization and hoping to make change when it comes to hospitalization. So I want to thank you, Jody, for being here. Yay!
Thank you, Chrissy.
And to Kat, wherever she went, she probably had to go. It is 4 o'clock. And thank all of the listeners for being here and taking the time to hear what we have to say about our own personal hospitalization experiences. Everybody's experience is unique and worth hearing. And it is not always the One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest saga that we probably think it
is.
So anyway, thank you for being here today. You're listening to Mental Illness Matters Radio, where we are changing the way people view mental illness one personal story at a time, and also talking about topics that need to be talked about more so to abolish the stigma of mental illness. We will see you next time. I'm not sure what the topic is going to be, but it's going to be 2 weeks from today. So we'll see you then. Thank you for joining us, and hope that you have a lovely holiday weekend. Bye now.
Bye-bye.